Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is David R. Herzog, and I represent the debtors, appellants in this case, Nicholas and Penny Stammett. This case is on appeal before this Court from a ruling of the District Court which affirmed the Bankruptcy Court's denial of the Stammett's discharge pursuant to 727 of the Bankruptcy Code. The trustee in this case has painted the Stammett's as dishonest persons, as dishonest people, alleging that they have made numerous omissions in their statement of financial affairs and in their schedules, and that as such dishonest persons that they are not entitled to the discharge which a Chapter 7 bankruptcy affords to them. And I would respectfully submit to this Court that the record does not even remotely suggest that these persons are dishonest, that they had any intent to deceive, to withhold assets from the trustee, or to conceal their financial affairs. The Stammett's in 341 meeting of creditors always answered all of the questions that were put to them concerning any assets or any past business or financial transactions.
But what about all these businesses they failed to list?
Well, Your Honor, I think...
They were all businesses the Question 18 clearly called for.
And I think we need to look to Question 18. I think there's no question that they listed their businesses, their current businesses, in Schedule B. That would be Stammett Pediatrics and On Time Billing. Those initially were omitted from question 18 or in response to question 18 of the Statement of Financial Affairs. But those were listed in Schedule B. There was no intent not to list them. They were inadvertently omitted.
Well, I mean, the list of excuses is we listed them somewhere else. We only made a little money on that one. Those businesses no longer existed.
Well, there were businesses that Dr. Stammett was involved in approximately almost 6 years previous. Mayer Medical, which had filed bankruptcy, and there were a couple of related entities involving that company that no longer existed, and that were not in response, were not initially listed into question as far as question 18 is concerned of the Statement of Financial Affairs. But what the trustee is focused on are two limited partnership interests which the trustee maintains should have been listed in response also to that question.
Let's even look at the it seems like it was a cat and mouse thing. As soon as the trustee would discover one thing, then they'd give up a little, and then the trustee would discover something else, they'd give up a little something else. Why did they wait until the trial to amend the bankruptcy petition to include the two home refinancings and the $10,000 settlement?
Well, they first of all readily disclosed that information, again, at a 341 at a deposition. They subsequently amended it because we felt that since the trustee had constantly raised this as an issue, it should be included. The question was, did it initially have to be listed in response to question 10? And question 10 requires that if you make a transfer, such as a settlement, or in this case the refinances, it asks for transfers which are outside of the ordinary course of business. Those are the only transactions which must be listed. And so the question is, are these three transactions out of the ordinary course of the debtor's financial affairs? Nothing in the record suggests that they are. We have a settlement of a lawsuit. Dr. Stammett was plagued by lawsuits at the time. He was sued by Oakbrook Financial Group for $15,000. He settled the case for $10,000. The trustee suggests that's an extraordinary transaction because of the amount. But the courts have suggested a transaction which is out of the ordinary course of business is one which raises the specter of a fraudulent conveyance, maybe a preference. None of that is suggested or none of that is operative here.
But did they settle any others, or is that the only one they settled?
At that time period, that was the only case which they settled.
But settling one but not others sounds like a preference to me. I don't know.
Well, it's beyond the preference period, so it could not have been a preference. They simply settled a lawsuit not quite 2 years before they filed a bankruptcy case. And they settled it for $10,000. And the only suggestion by the trustee is that this is out of the ordinary course of business is because it was for $10,000. And the same thing applies with respect to the refinance transactions. And this is a time period when Americans are refinancing properties by the boatload, and people are taking equity out of their property. Is this, in their particular financial affairs, out of the ordinary course of business? And it was done in the backdrop of the fact that Dr. Stammett was in the midst of a lawsuit in which he was enjoined from using any of his monies that he earned in his business because he had a dispute with his business partner. The Stammetts testified that the only monies that they could live upon were their retirement income, so they refinanced their property, they deposited all the monies into their personal bank account, and they lived on those monies, and they operated their businesses. So there's nothing in the record which suggests that this is a transaction which is out of the ordinary course of business. So in answer to your question, Judge Williams, no, I don't believe they were paying cat and mouse. I don't believe that they had to list these transactions in their bankruptcy petition, but they did so because the U.S. trustee said, we believe that these should be listed, and so ultimately they were listed. Now, one of the other arguments which the trustee makes, and again another admission which they allege is an omission, which, again, I don't believe is an admission, is that in response to question number one of the Statement of Financial Affairs, they assert that the debtors should have listed the gross income from the LLC rather than the income which they received from the LLC. And question one is very specific. It states, in particular, state all monies, gross income you receive from the operation of your business, from employment, from trade. The bankruptcy court conceded to the trustee's position and said, yes, you should have listed the gross income of the LLC because under the tax code, they receive the pass-through taxation benefit because of the fact that there is a single member LLC. And the district court refused to rule on that particular issue. But again, it is raised by the trustee. And even in their analysis, they're incorrect because even under the tax law, the gross income, which is scheduled under Schedule C of an individual taxpayer's tax return, is listed in response to number 12 of a 1040 return is the gross income received from the business. So the pass-through is the net profit from the business. That's the pass-through, and that is what should be listed, and not the gross income, which is of a separate taxpayer. The LLCs were separate corporations. They had separate taxpayer identification numbers. And therefore, in my opinion, I would respectfully submit was not required to be listed in response to question number one. With respect, the trustee also has maintained that there was a counterclaim which the Stammetts allegedly hid or concealed. And again, the record is without real evidence as to the existence of such a counterclaim at the time the bankruptcy case was filed. There is testimony in which Mrs. Stammett is asked whether or not there was a counterclaim filed in a lawsuit filed by Standard Bank seeking to invalidate a mortgage. And Mrs. Stammen says, well, we were suing each other, and I think that was the case, or I believe that was the case. We've been suing each other since 2001. When asked directly on examination, do you know if there was an existence of a counterclaim at the time you filed bankruptcy? She said, I don't know. And this was a simple matter of proof. All the trustee had to do was introduce a court docket from the state court if, in fact, such a counterclaim existed. No such evidence was introduced. The record is completely barren, other than the speculation that such a counterclaim existed at the time. There was also the urging in their briefs by the U.S. trustee that the debtors failed to satisfactorily explain the loss of assets. And in particular, they now point to the two refinance transactions and argue and assert that the debtors never explained what they did with the proceeds. And again, if we look at the record, we simply see that the debtors testified that when they received these refinance proceeds, they deposited all the monies into their personal checking account. They did not conceal these monies. They didn't secret the monies. They didn't hide the monies. They put it into their personal checking account. As part of the exhibits of trial, they produced all of their records. They produced all of their checking account statements. They produced the canceled checks, both as exhibits, their personal exhibits, as well as both of their limited liability companies, so that the record was complete with all of these particular exhibits. And yet, the trustee never once identified a particular transaction, never once provided a check to the Stammets and said, looking at this check, can you explain what these proceeds were used for? And it wasn't the burden of the debtors to try to identify transactions to explain. It was the burden of the trustee to do so. And they never at once asked one question during the trial as to the use of particular proceeds. I would suggest and I would submit to your honors that what we have here is a hodgepodge of purported omissions, which really are not admissions. There's not one evidence. There's no evidence.
You know, you're way into your rebuttal time.
Then I will conclude and say there's simply no evidence here of them trying to conceal or hide any material asset in this case. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Cox. Hi.
Good morning. May it please the panel, I'm Wendy Cox. I'm with the United States Department of Justice, and I'm representing the United States trustee in this appeal.
What is the best evidence that a counterclaim existed? Are you relying solely on the rather ambiguous and confused testimony of Mrs. Stammett?
We are relying on the testimony of Mrs. Stammett. We're also, Mrs. Stammett.
Wasn't that a stretch?
Well, Mrs. Stammett.
To say, you know, that we've got to resolve credibility question by the bankruptcy court when both pieces of testimony came from the same witness and the witness sounded confused. I mean, lawyers know what counterclaims are. I don't know if math majors do.
Well, Your Honor, the witness, they listed the case of the chief in response to question 4 on their sofa, so they knew about the case. And Ms. Stammett knew that she testified at trial that she knew that they had been suing them. So she knew that they had been suing them, and she had an obligation to list that.
That was a publicly available pleading. Was that in the record?
The counterclaim? Yes, my understanding is that the counterclaim was available, but because the information came out late just before trial, we weren't able to get a self-authenticating copy before the trial. But Mrs. Stamet, the Stamets are very educated people, and they had experienced bankruptcy counsel, and they had counsel for the case in which the counterclaim was pled. And they had a responsibility to make inquiry, to determine in response to these schedules whether they had any counterclaims or not. I don't think they should be able to hide behind the fact that they failed to make an inquiry to sort of claim ignorance and then say, you know, just claim that they didn't know. She knew there was something there. She told the bankruptcy court that they had been suing Standard Bank.
You know, they also say they produced bank records that would tell the trustee what happened to the $90,000 that they, you know, that they took out of the equity of that second home. And in the, you know, you tell us in the brief that those records are part of the record on appeal. Did you review those records?
Yes, Your Honor. Those records are part of the records on appeal, and we do have the bank statements, and we'd be happy to, I guess they are here in paper form, but if you'd like them in a more convenient form, we'd be happy to get them to you. In reviewing those records, we did a little spreadsheet and determined the problem with the records is that the Stamets appeared to do a lot of transfers in cash. So the bank statements from their personal account show actually from September 05, they actually had 42 checks that were made out to cash, some as much as $8,000, for a total of $29,000. So they didn't have any checks made out to Stamet Pediatrics, even though Ms. Stamet testified that they had used their money. They had put their money into the business. So the problem, Your Honor, is that there isn't any real documentation of what happened to that money. We have the testimony, but Mrs. Stamet was a business controller, and one might expect from a business controller that if she were making loans to a corporation that there would be some sort of loan documentation, something setting forth the terms of the loan or, you know, the repayment plan or whatever, but there was nothing like that. There were simply checks made out to cash that Mrs. Stamet says, some of which went to the business. So really, there really what the bankruptcy court found was that the explanation itself was sort of vague. There was this, you know, pot of money. There was the business's money and the Stamets' money, but there really wasn't a real distinction between those two pots of money. Mrs. Stamet testified that she would take money out of the personal account to pay the business expenses, and that she, you know, if there was money in the business account, they might take that out and put it in the personal account. But there's no record of any of these transactions, and that's a business controller is sort of the last person that you would expect to make these kind of transactions, and that raises the issue particularly with the funds from the cash outs from their second home, is we don't know where this money went. This money, the Stamets either spent it or they put it into this, you know, affiliated entity that they owned and controlled, and that money could have been used perhaps to pay their creditors. But instead, they put it into their own business, which they've testified they've taken money from with no documentation. So the court was not clearly erroneous in finding that they failed to provide satisfactory documentation that showed what they did with those funds, with that $90,000 that they cashed out of their second home. Really, there were many, many facts. This is an abuse of discretion case, and it turns on the facts that the court found. And really, there were many, many facts that supported the bankruptcy court's finding of false oaths. The Stamets were educated financially savvy people. Mrs. Stammett had been a business controller. She had an accounting degree. She owned and operated a billing company. They had an accountant. They had experienced bankruptcy counsel. They certainly had the ability and the resources to figure out what these statements and schedules meant and to inquire and to come up with, you know, the correct information. But they didn't do that. They're, even though they signed these things, they signed the statements and schedules under penalty of perjury, and they testified that they understood their obligations and that they understood the questions. The information was full of errors and omissions. There was, by my count, there were 14, but, and you all mentioned some of them, there were 7 businesses that they didn't omit. They were wrong. Admitted, they concede that the gross income that they reported in response to question one is just wrong. They didn't report the $90,000 that they cashed out of their second home. They had the, you know, the counterclaim, and they had the settlement payment. I mean, there were just, we're not talking about debtors who made, you know, one error. We're talking about a whole pattern that showed that they simply didn't care about the accuracy of their statements. And as you pointed out, they weren't in any hurry to correct those errors. Other people identified the truth and brought it up and raised it to them, and they still didn't promptly correct their schedules and statements to make sure that they had the correct information. They waited until the eve of trial, and even then they didn't correct all of them, only some of them. And the bankruptcy court listened to their explanations. They had a number of explanations for their errors. The bankruptcy court listened, and just given, you know, the Stammett's, given the schedules, given and the statements and who the Stammett's were, the bankruptcy court just didn't find those explanations credible. The bankruptcy court got to observe the Stammett's, listen to their testimony, and it just didn't find them believable or convincing. So really, there are too many errors here. There are too many errors with no credible explanations, and that's why the bankruptcy court was well within its discretion to deny the Stammett's a discharge. On both on the issue of the bankruptcy court denied it on 3 grounds, and this court can affirm on any of the 3. And we believe that there was no abuse of discretion on any of the 3 grounds. That would be the failure to satisfactorily explain and document what happened to the funds from the refinancing. That's the A5. The making of false oaths in the bankruptcy schedules and statements, which is the A4, and the concealment of assets, which is the A2. I'll just finish by saying that the schedules and the statements were pretty straightforward. These schedules and statements are filled out by debtors in all walks of life. The statement seemed particularly well suited to be able to, you know, to be able to complete them successfully, and they didn't. And they have a lot of excuses, but none of those excuses were very credible or very convincing. So there was no abuse of discretion. And if you don't have any questions, I'll conclude.
Thank you. Will you add another minute to Mr. Herzog's time?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Your Honor asked if there was any evidence as to the counterclaim, and there was no evidence. And the excuse of saying, well, we just thought about this at the last minute, doesn't stand at a trial. Either you produce evidence or you don't produce evidence.
I thought they said there was no evidence of the value of the counterclaim, not its existence. They found the existence based on what she testified to. The judge said there must be a counterclaim.
Well, I don't believe that's
the case.
No,
the value of it.
I respectfully disagree with Your Honor. I don't think that they discussed value. They discussed the existence. And the simplest way to have proved the existence was to have produced the court docket, if in fact it did exist. And there was no. We operate under a system of proof. And proof in a trial would have required a simple document. And we could have proved, or they could have proved, the existence or the non-existence of that counterclaim at the time the bankruptcy case was filed by simply introducing a document. The other thing I'd just like to comment also on is the fact that the trustee says, well, you didn't explain your transactions. But the trustee now says, well, there were all of these cash transactions, but never once at trial asked the Stamets to identify or ask what or explain what happened to these particular funds or proceeds. The Stamets weren't supposed to guess what the trustee wanted to know. The trustee can only, or the Stamets could have only answered if it was the question had been properly put to them. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you.